Blog Talk Radio.
Famously, if unimaginatively, called the Saturn return, or more precisely, the first Saturn return. If you keep eating your granola, you'll have another one when you're just short of 60, at about 59, the second Saturn return. And life can be understood in approximate terms as three Saturn cycles. By the time we would be coming to a third Saturn return, we would be pretty much at our 4 score and 10. Many of us make it that long. Some of us last a little bit longer. Obviously, your mileage will vary, But in essence, life is three Saturn cycles, and turning 30 means you are leaving the first cycle and entering the second one, rather obviously. These three cycles could be understood as youth and midlife and the cycle of the elder. In this video, I want to talk about the first Saturn return and how to navigate this transition as consciously and gracefully and meaningfully as you possibly can. It's critical that you do that because your happiness and well-being for the rest of your life ride upon decisions and changes that you make during this period of, let's say, a couple of years while Saturn is passing through the sign that it was in when you were born. A good professional astrologer can give you the exact dates, but for everybody, it's between the 29th and the 30th birthdays that will be going through this experience. Now, let me draw an analogy. When you were perhaps 12 years old, the biochemical floodgates opened up and you experienced puberty, and it changed everything in terms of your attitude towards yourself, what was important in life, your social relationships, you name it. Everything utterly, utterly altered. How could we possibly explain human sexuality to an intelligent 6-year-old, and yet what 16-year-old is immune to it? It utterly alters our perspective, and the Saturn return operates rather similarly. To understand the nature of the transition that you are facing now, I want to begin by talking about what you have accomplished so far in life. And here again, I am addressing those who are about to experience their 30th birthdays. The purpose of the first Saturn cycle, the purpose of youth, in essence, is the gathering of a vision, trying to figure out who you are, what you're going to do with your life. The purpose of youth, in a sense, is to dream. And I don't narrowly mean dreams at night, although we'll often have great formative dreams in those early years. But I mean to form the aspirations based on your identity. What kind of life do you want to live? What is your soul's purpose in the world? Would be a loftier way of saying exactly the same thing. So we plug into some common sense here. When we think of a person, let's say of 22, a relatively young adult who has just graduated from college and been offered a stable, lucrative, but boring position in a big corporation. And this 22-year-old decides to take the position, and they're all excited about the retirement plan. Isn't that depressing, just as I say it? Let's compare this with a 22-year-old who has been offered such a position and says, I don't think I'm going to take it. Am I crazy? But I am going to go work in the Caribbean as a cocktail waiter for a year and see what develops. And, well, is that what you want to do for the rest of your life? And the person says, no. Why are you doing it? Well, just for the adventure of it. If we think of these two 22-year-olds, the one who takes the corporate position and the one who goes off to the Caribbean for a little bit of an adventure, which of these two would you prefer to have join you for dinner on the occasion of their 40th birthdays? I think for most of us, that's a pretty easy question. We have a sense that the second young adult is going to be a much more interesting dinner companion at age 40 than will the first one. Because in youth, we should not pin ourselves down. We don't know who we are yet. It's not that we should be totally phobic about commitment, but we should be careful about selling our freedom down the river. The purpose of the first cycle of life is this dreaming, gathering of the great adventure of life, trying to figure out who we are, keeping our options open. I always kind of visualize a great ball of light expanding within a kind of irregularly shaped crystalline structure, like a diamond, but not quite so symmetrical. And as this balloon of light expands, it will hit some of the facets on the inside of this diamond and begin to hit its limits, begin to hit its structures. This is the metaphor I want to use. Now, with Saturn, we always think of the word limitation, which is seemingly sort of a negative word, but I don't think we should view it that way. I think through limitation, we have definition and identity. So as the great ball of the self, the great sphere of the self begins to expand within the potential shape of our adult identity, early on, it begins to hit these facets, hit these walls. So there was a time when you were maybe 2 years old, when you became aware of a limitation that would define you for the rest of your life, that would in one fell swoop eliminate half of all human experience. This was the realization that I am a little girl, or I am a little boy. You have a gender. And when you were like 2 years old or something and realized that there were boys and there were girls in the world and I am this one but I am not that one, the feeling that arose in you was, aha, that's something about me. I know something about myself. I am a little boy or a little girl of this race or of this ethnicity or living in this city or of this religion. In each case, there's a sense of a limit being hit and definition and the feeling of, ah, I'm coming to know myself. But all through the first cycle, all through what you have experienced so far in your life, there's a sense of a little more space, like I haven't fully expanded to take the shape of my adult identity until we come to the Saturn return, which closes the circle of limitation, and there arises in the consciousness, here I am. This is it. I must make my stand. If we have gathered our visions with enthusiasm, if we haven't sold our freedom down the river in the first cycle of life, by the time we get to this Saturn return, we have a foundation of meaningfulness and direction in our lives, and it's time to make it real at the Saturn return. Let me enter this story in yet another way. I imagine.
Okay, I'm back, and again, that was, like I said, just a preview. And one thing about your Saturn return, you know, most adults do not consider you to be fully grown until you're about 30 anyway, and they don't really have a tendency to take you seriously. They may agree that you have something interesting to say, but they don't see you as having taken life serious yet. And there's that period there between 25 in your Saturn return, where Neptune makes its first sextile to its natal position. And there's usually a period there where a lot of people will go through an experimentation with drugs or booze or whatever. That's a highly delusional phase for a lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people. And this is where the 27 Club comes from. Where all of the dead musicians, et cetera, seem to lose it and kill themselves in one way, shape, or form. This was a period for me where I started learning about the occult. Again, Neptune, sextile Neptune, has a tendency to want to create an attraction to mystical subjects. And so that sort of led me into astrology at that point. And since I have not quite approached or hit the point where I'm at my second Saturn return, I can't say that I have fully matured as an astrologer yet. Now, I as far as my career goes, like I said, you can do a chart for anything that has a beginning. Well, I got my first job in the profession that I'm in when I was 22. And so I've just recently had my Saturn return in my career. So, again, you can apply astrology to many things. Now, I'm going to go ahead and play the clip on the second Saturn return. And you younger folks, just bear with it for a little bit and let the ones who have already had their first Saturn return listen to this one about them.
Well, happy birthday coming up, birthday with a zero in it, turning 60. This is called the second Saturn return in technical astrology. It has the very simple meaning that Saturn has returned to the place it was when you were born for the second time. Saturn's orbit, in fact, around the sun takes 29 and a half years. So when we're approximately 59 and thus looking down the barrel of turning 60, we are in the Saturn return. There's a little bit of variation. It's not always the 59th birthday because we're watching Saturn's position in the sky from the moving Earth and it flips it around a little bit. But everybody, when they're between the time they're, say, 58 and a half and 60, they're going to be looking at this second Saturn return. And it changes everything, as we will soon see. It changes one's entire identity and perspective on life. And most importantly, it changes the map that you need to follow to find happiness in your life. The old rules don't work anymore, but there are some new rules that do work, and they work fine. And in fact, they work better than any rules you've ever lived with before, and we'll be exploring that too here. So we have three cycles in life, the first Saturn cycle, the second one, and the third one. By the time we have gotten to the end of the third cycle, we're getting pretty close to our 40 and 10 years, and most of us have left the world, although a significant number of us will live on a bit into the next Saturn cycle, but basically three Saturn cycles, and we'll call them youth and midlife and the cycle of the elder. So if you're in your second Saturn return now, which I assume is why you're probably watching this video, there's a need to essentially kiss midlife goodbye and embrace the elder. I say embrace the elder. I encourage you to be positive about this. In fact, I hope that one effect that you will experience from listening to these words over the next little while is that you will find some support in your encouragement for becoming older. There's reason to imagine that what lies ahead for you will be the happiest time of your life. I know that in many circles that would seem like I was being a bit of a cheerleader, maybe a bit too optimistic. We are so conditioned to imagine that the final decades of life are something to be feared or something about which we should be depressed. I think there's excellent reason to think quite differently. And some of it is really quite obvious. Remember how awful it was to be a teenager. Only the most foolish of elders is going to look back on their teenage years and wish they were there again. When we're teenagers, we worry about so much that seems trivial. We worried about the shape of our nose and what other people think of us and all of that. We get into our 20s. And we maybe calm down a little bit. 20s compare pretty favorably to the teenage years in the category of happiness or sanity. But then we get into our 30s and we think back at our 20s and we realize how crazy we were in our 20s. And then we get to our 40s and we think back to our 30s and we realize how crazy we were in our 30s. And in each of these decades, there's a certain validity to these perceptions. I'm saying it sort of lightly and playfully. It might even sound like I'm joking, but I'm not joking. We become saner. We work on ourselves. We develop more wisdom. And this has something to do with happiness. When I say happiness, I don't mean wild Dionysian release. We may be at our best at that when we're 25 or something. But the peace that passeth all understanding, the peace of wisdom, the serenity of spirit, self-acceptance, the real basis of substantial well-being, all of that seems to improve as years go by. And there's no evidence in most of our lives that this reverses itself. And why not have the happy anticipation that the years ahead will involve a deepening of this well-being, a deepening of this happiness, a deepening of this wisdom. We can make a further case for it. Half of what makes us crazy, half of what makes us sad or angry or depressed in this world has to do with what we desire and what we fear. And so desires, you know, desiring money, let's say, or power or prestige, or even sex. As we get older, it's not that we necessarily lose interest in all those things, but their grip on us is not quite as penetrating, not quite as fierce. We make $137 million in a state lottery when we're 35 years old, and it's going to completely change our lives. If we're 70 and we suddenly have that much money, it's going to have an effect, of course, but there's an excellent chance we'll give a lot of it away, and the impact of it won't be so great. We get to appear on national television in some flattering light when we're 35, and it goes straight to our head. When we're 70, we kind of get the joke about it. The world doesn't grip us quite so tightly as we get older, and its ability to make us crazy becomes less. So at the Saturn return, at the second Saturn return, as we cross the line into elderhood, there is a dramatic intensification of these very changes that I've been talking about. A kind of relaxation about the trivial things of life seems to come into our heads. We lose some of our attachment to that. And this is a good reason to celebrate and embrace the aging process and to recognize that there's a good rational basis for expecting that we'll be happier. Many would come in and object and say, but terrible things happen to our bodies as we get older. We can become debilitated. We can become ill. We will surely die sooner or later. And we're a little closer to it, presumably, in our old age. And, you know, those are scary things, admittedly, and they can potentially be horrible. But even there, if a doctor were to face you when you were 40 years old and say, I've got bad news for you, and you're given some fatal medical diagnosis at age 40, presumably it's a completely devastating event. As we get older, I guess we're sort of getting used to the idea that it'll happen sooner or later. And maybe we have a little bit more of our life behind us, and we've done more of what we set out to do in life spiritually and in other ways, and a doctor hits us with such a diagnosis, and it gets our full attention. I'm not trying to make light of it. It's a heavy thing. But we feel it better than we would have when we're 40. I doubt what I'm saying is universally true, but I suspect it's true in a majority sense that generally our increasing wisdom and increasing acceptance of life's realities even supports us in facing the most horrible things that can happen to us in our final years. Again, every reason to believe that happiness can be strengthened. So these are encouraging things that I'm saying. Let me shift our gears a little bit and speak of the Saturn return in a different way.
Okay, I'm back. Well, I took a look at the chat room during that video, and I could certainly see roughly the age of the people who are active in the chat room, because they all of a sudden got real active on other subjects. So anyway, I hope everybody got something out of those two clips regarding Saturn. And if you have already had your first Saturn return, you know, and you're not familiar with astrology, just go back and, you know, think about that period in your life in your very late 20s, right before you turn 30, and closely examine the events that happen. You'll notice the Saturn returns will tie in very closely to the house and sign position. because that is your weak spot in your chart. That is basically where you are at your very weakest, and that is the areas that require the most attention. Okay, so what I'm going to do here, I'm going to play a song, and I've got to go to the restroom real quick, and then we'll come back and wrap this show up, and we'll look forward to the next show on Sunday. I'll be right back. Okay, I'm back. So, again, what happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants? Well, you've caught a little preview of what can happen. I'm going to close out with some final thoughts. The truth is hate only to those who hate the truth. A noble society is not ruled by might but by law. Preserving your culture isn't hate. It's about survival. You do not have the right to never be offended. The fact that they want our guns is all the more reason to have them. There are no illegal guns, only illegal gun laws. Anti-gun is anti-white. Anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. Free men aren't equal, and equal men aren't free. Odin demands that you grow the fuck up. Distinct peoples have a right to remain distinct. Multiracialism is not self-government. Forced association isn't freedom. 1488, and we're going to close out with some outlaws, ghost riders in the sky. So until next time, hail Satan.
Thank you. Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome, everybody, to the Dragon's Lair on Renegade Broadcasting, the best source for factual information on the planet. I'm not using Skype tonight because of all the problems I've been having, especially with the astrology shows. So I'm using a regular telephone with a headset. I'll try to get this resolved during the week so the next shows will hopefully be all right. We'll see what happens. For the record, today is April 14th, 2013 on our screwed up Christian calendar. The sun is at 24 degrees Aries. Be sure and give a listen to all the other hosts here on Renegade. Until further notice, we have Kyle on Mondays. Dana from Truth Militia will be here on Tuesdays. Lou is on Wednesdays. Mike is on Thursdays. Siegfried is on Fridays. Roundtable on Saturdays. And me, of course, on Sundays. As usual, I will typically not monitor the chat. However, tonight I might monitor it more than usual, and I'll explain in a minute. I'll be smoking and drinking my water here where I sit. We have a chat at renegadebroadcasting.com. I believe we may have a live feed there tonight. The same chat also exists at renegadebroadcasting.chitango.com. And also over at Kyle's social network, alternativesocial.com. I want everybody to remember and to go to nationalprotectionism.com and become active, stay active, get active, continue to be active, whatever the case may be. Again, I have no personal website or blog. I'll probably not have a life if I did. I'm not going to take calls tonight. I mentioned that I might possibly would on my previous shows. However, what I've decided to do here is go ahead and do this show as an astrology show, and I'm going to do my next one on next Sunday as an astrology show. I've decided to go ahead and just give everything that I've got on this to everybody on these particular issues, and at a later point I'll do other astrology shows, but it'll be more on mechanics. Unless I discover something just really interesting to pass on to everybody or new information arises. If you want to contact me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com. That is magus_18@geocities.com. If you want to subscribe, just put subscribe in the subject, or you can just write me. I can't guarantee I'll get to all of my emails. And any of you who have just recently sent me a subscribe email, I do have it. I do, and I will add you next time I send something out. If you're on my list, you received all promised emailings except for the links, and I'm going to hold off until after the next show because I have a lot more to add for this show and the next one. I've done a little bit more research and found some rather interesting videos that I'm going to play the audio to tonight. And I think everybody will be able to gain something from it. So, again, after the next show, I'll be sending out the rest of these links. And the cat is around here in the backyard, I think. Could be on the back porch. She's not here with me, though. So, anyway, we're going to go ahead and play one more song, and we'll get into the show tonight. So, let's see, where is it? Here it is. Some CCR. First of all, the show will get better as it goes on because I've got some really interesting stuff here towards the end. And what I'm going to do is I've got tonight, I think I've got three different astrologers that will be that have given presentations on YouTube that I want you guys to hear. And again, you're going to have to follow these closely to really grasp what's going on, but you've got enough background from my previous shows to understand what's being said. And even if you're not into astrology, you still get the gist of what's going on. Now, before I go any further here, I've got a little chart that I found that shows how the astrological signs correlate to music. You can ultimately categorize everything on this planet into something to do with astrology in one way, shape, or form. And music is one of them, as well as colors. Each one of the colors has a correspondence to an astrological sign. I'm going to run through these notes here, and believe me, I don't know anything about music other than being able to tell you what I like. So anyway, Aries corresponds to D, Taurus corresponds to E, Gemini corresponds to F, Cancer will correspond to A, Leo corresponds to B, and Virgo corresponds to C, Libra corresponds to D, Scorpio corresponds to E, Sagittarius also corresponds to F, Capricorn corresponds to G, Aquarius to A, and Pisces to B. Now, of course, there's also other ones in here, like, and I do not understand this, you have like D major, B minor, C minor, et cetera, but I won't go through those. I just kind of wanted to let you know that if you wanted to look into that, then it's, if you are musically inclined and understand all the notes, et cetera, it is there. And maybe someone who does understand music can take a sheet of music that someone has written and work out the astrology to it. So anyway, some other things that are involved in the chart, I don't want to give anybody the idea that, you know, I've covered everything. There is just so much to this. For example, there's things like stelliums, asteroids, there's relocation astrology, synastry and composite astrology, and synastry and composite are relationships. You take somebody's chart and compare it to yours, and then there's such a thing as a composite chart. I think I mentioned that once before, where you find the midpoints between everything in each other's charts. So you take the Venus of one person, the Venus of another, and find out the location of each, and then figure out what that midpoint is, and then you do a chart for that. That is probably the best way to see how a relationship will work out. There's also financial astrology, mundane astrology, which is mainly what we've been focusing on here lately, other than natal. There's such things as intercepted signs, and then there's midpoints, as I discussed with composite. There's also the fixed stars, and then there's mathematical points, such as the vertex, the anti-vertex, the east point, the west point. And then there are Arabic parts. Typically in Western astrology, the only Arabic part that gets used is what's called the part of fortune. And then there's elements, fire, earth, air, and water. Now, those are the qualities of the elements, of course. You have liquid, solid, gas, and energy. And then there's things like mutual reception. And then there's critical and anaretic degrees, peregrine planets, etc. Now, also, too, we've been talking a lot about Uranus square Pluto, and I wanted to give the dates on this because this is really something I consider to be important. Now, this is unusual to have this many squares, and these are from 2012 through 2015, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times when this square will be exact. And the first one occurred on June 24th of 2012. The second one occurred on September 19th of 2012. The next one will occur on May 21st, 2013, which is within about a little more than a month. Then November 1st of this year. And then in 2014, it will happen twice, April 21st and December 15th. And then once in 2015, on March 17th. So you can see we've only had two contacts so far out of these seven exact, out of the seven times that this square is exact. Now, what I want to really emphasize tonight in particular, I've mentioned before how our enemies use astrology to work against us. And in particular, that was significantly subverted during the mid-1960s. And we'll touch a little bit on the 60s tonight, but we'll also see also how that correlates to today. Because in the 1960s, you actually had a Uranus conjunct Pluto in transit in about 1960, around the period of 1965, a little before and a little after. And you can just look back in history and see what happened. Now, of course, a conjunction is a little bit, is actually the most strongest aspect. After that, it's the square and the opposition. However, the opposition corresponds more to a moon cycle. So a conjunction would be like a new moon, and an opposition would be like a full moon, whereas the square is directly in between. So in a way, that's kind of a mid, square is kind of a midpoint between the, a new moon and a full moon. And what I want to emphasize here is how they use the Fabian socialism tactics of lying low for a while, still working their issues as always, but when the time is right, they hit and they hit hard. And I suspect since we still have five more times when this square will be exact, they're really going to start hitting hard. I think we've just seen the tip of the iceberg with some of the issues that are going on right now. And it's pretty blatant to see how Obama fits into all of this. So anyway, I'm going to play several videos here tonight of three different astrologers, and each one is roughly, 8 to 10 minutes long. The first guy is a Turkish astrologer, and so you have to listen carefully because of his accent, and he actually brings up globalism and nationalism. Okay, so without further ado, here we go.
I was born just actually when Uranus Pluto conjunct, it was 67, so I am from this generation, but the Pluto Capricorn issue, Pluto is, Capricorn is this material civilization, and when you look back to the history, it was in Aries in the early 1820s, from 1822 to 1852, and if you consider Pluto Capricorn first from a point, a culmination point from Aries, then now we are going to have the products of or the conclusions of what happened in the 1820s. And I saw that Ottoman Empire, for example, was the solution during this period, and also it is a kind of, again, revolutions, also July Revolution in French. And this whole concept, this whole cycle now will be again triggered by Uranus-Pluto square, because it was a new moon in the 60s. I mean, it was a conjunction, so a conjunction is a kind of new moon. But Uranus also will be in Aries too. So Aries is a sign of new beginnings. I think this change could be especially in terms of social rights and this the role of the state and the governments. I think we are going to have the first crisis of globalization. I would like to compare actually Capricorn in terms of Aries, because if you are between Aries and Capricorn, it is the culmination of efforts. When we put a seed in Aries, then we get the culmination of our efforts in Capricorn phase. So Capricorn, in a way, is the end result of Aries, what we began and then what we got it at the Capricorn phase. But during this time, 1822, between 1852, Ottoman Empire began to dissolve, and it is not only the empire dissolving, but nationalism also was growing during that time. And I could say that it was also a period of changing circumstances, political circumstances, very rapidly changing circumstances of the world. And now Pluto entered already Capricorn and will be have a visit with Uranus in the sky. So this could be quite very drastic changes possible, which will be maybe related with nationalism and the states and the growing unsteadiness within the people. When I was born in 67, actually, of course, I'm not able to remember those days, but for me, Uranus, it is the individuality perfected, and it is also a component of higher mind of ourselves, and by Uranus we can see the king naked. But Pluto, which is the irreversible change and the only the change we can believe in philosophy, as Greek philosophers said, and if you combine these together, then Uranus Pluto square, it's going to be very dynamic, because these square will be in cardinal signs, and if you combine Uranus with Aries, it is a kind of personality, it's a kind of impulsive expression of freedom against very structured, very rigid structures, actually. So this is going to be very, very creative, but in the same time quite big changes in terms of people and the state. And as we can see, it's a kind of I am on the negative side, actually. It is it is like George Orwell's 1984 something. I mean, because now we are living in conditions, we are being observed and we recorded every time, and I think all these issues will come out, and individual and the state, we have to find a new equilibrium between those. It is interesting, because it is also, you know, it will be hitting China, because I have been studying on China's chart, and China has 7 degree Libra Sun, and also it is in square to natal Uranus in Cancer. So China has going to have Pluto square Uranus to directly to its Sun. I think this change also will involve China directly, and I would say that now we are having the recession, the global recession, economic recession, actually would grow, and the fragile balance between China and America should be watched, because it is such a balance, because the 70% of national product GDP of China is coming from exports to mainly to America, and America is financed by China, and it is a kind of balance, it is a mutual assured destruction. So when one of the partners collapse, then there could be big changes in China. So far, CCP, China Communist Party, has been able to govern China in a way, because of the tremendous economic policies and achievements. But if this achievement, economic growth, couldn't be maintained, so they're going to be quite actually problems growing here within the society, the Chinese society, and this whole this issue actually could be built up, could be treated.
Okay, we'll proceed to part two. He'll pick up where he left off.
Talk of the end of the Mayan calendar, of 2012, time wave zero, and how do you as an astrologer look at that, that's getting more and more present every day?
I got interested in Mayan astrology very much within the last few years, it is also another, I think, expression that we are living through, because during the 60s, especially in the late 60s, we had this whole change of production methods, and also as a result of this, the ecologic problems also, we began to feel that they are important as well, and there are green parties established in Germany, and so in the meantime, I think in this square, we are going to experience that a Gaia project, world as a living substance. We will acknowledge that we have to preserve what we have. Otherwise, we're going to have quite problems, or the Earth herself could react to our abuse, actually. So we are getting tested, actually, during this period. And this is another actually important result of the cycle. It is also not only the ecology, but also in the meantime, it is the ethics, how we produce and how we consume. Do we consume moderately, or do we consume without any thought? Because Capricorn, it is a sign of scarcity, actually. And now, now on to 2024, then we are going to have all this period, and we have to be quite conscious what we are doing. Capricorn is a sign of restriction, so we are not maybe able to move on as we like it. There are many concerns, and morality and prudence, all these concepts will be on the agenda of our political and living agenda of our daily lives. In the first sense, because the earth element now being felt much stronger, now whole world begins to aware, we have to be thrifty, and we have to go on the side of savings, but also especially this square aspect, it's a kind of alarm bell for everyone. And by using astrology, if we are able to convey our thoughts successfully, then maybe we are not late, but this is a continuous process. And in every case, history itself choose the leaders and picks up the leaders and organize the events. And we are by astrology we can understand the zeitgeist or the spirit of time, but we can create of our thoughts, and we can defend ourselves in a way. I mean, it's a kind of test, actually. If we convey our thoughts successfully, and if we look at the whole picture, and if we give examples from history, we could give the politicians or even to those the men in the streets, we could be much more understood in this way. I have an assumption. This is it. Now on the elections, presidential, I mean the 4th of November, there will be the first opposition between Saturn and Uranus. And it is interesting because this opposition will occur until it will be finished completely in 2010. But there will be five oppositions, and I noticed that Uranus entered Pisces in 2003, and this was the time America invaded Iraq. And in the meantime, Saturn entered Virgo in September 2007. And now, at that time, what happened actually from September last year? America saw that the military forces has to be withdrawn, and finally it is admitted that they cannot stay forever there. And now we are going to have this opposition, Saturn in the 10th house in terms of whole sciences, and Uranus in the 4th, of course, showing the homeland security is quite, and the opposition to government is quite fragile. And whole issue, centering the elections actually will be on this. I mean, how long we are going to stay in Iraq or in the Middle East. And if you look back, what happened? Because earlier, when Jupiter Saturn conjunct, they were together in Taurus, starting from year 2000, and it was the Bush government. Put the idea of this Grand Middle East program or Grand Middle East plan. And now we are also going to have Jupiter-Saturn opposition in year 2010 along with this Uranus-Saturn opposition in the cardinal axis. I think my estimation or my prediction is that in every case, America has to withdraw forces until year 2010, and new equilibrium will be there. Of course, it is not easy to elect the president, but America has Sun progressing in Pisces, and I can guess that within the next 25 years or 20 years, we can only talk about a post-American world, and I think it is the rest now will be leading. America may adapt herself into this new conditions in the world, and probably if you look at the China chart, starting from year 2020, China will be a much stronger figure. Now we are hearing the signals, but starting from the next Jupiter-Saturn conjunction in Aquarius, the whole picture will be changed in this direction.
Okay, I'm back. Post-American. Okay, I think we need to make that post-Jew American. Perhaps a new America would be more appropriate. Again, these astrologers don't always know the things that we know. And again, I've mentioned, as I mentioned before, it's my perspective is rather unique since I understand astrology and the politics behind all of this. I've got a series of four videos here from the Levine guy that did the quantum astrology, and he's going to kind of correlate some of the 60s to the 90s. I think actually he could have perhaps done a little bit better job than what he did, but these are still worth listening to. He does bring up some interesting issues on some things. However, the guy that follows him really gets into some things that are you're going to find rather interesting. And like I said, the show is going to get better as it goes on. Now I'm going to play a couple of these here, and we'll probably wind up being at the top of the hour after two of them. And at the top of the hour, I'll play play some music, and then we'll come back and listen to the other two. All right, without further ado.
There's no question about it that these are extraordinary times. And as an astrologer, time is my primary interest. Most people don't realize that astrology is really a body of information that is used to better understand cycles of time. As astrologers, we look to the rhythms of the Sun and the Moon and Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. And from Earth's point of view, we watch these planets moving around in their regular cycles as our ancestors have done for eons. As an astrologer, I am particularly interested in how these moving planetary rhythms impact the lives of my clients, of myself, of the loved ones in my life. However, that's not what we're here to talk about now. Astrology can also be used to better understand the larger rhythms, what we call the cycles of history. In astrology, some of the planetary movements are rather rapid, meaning that the moon takes only one month, to make one complete cycle through the zodiac. However, when we move to the outer planets, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, these planets take from 30 years, Saturn, about 29 or 30 years, to make one complete journey around the sun, or from the astrological point of view, one complete journey through the zodiac. Uranus takes about 84 years. Neptune takes about 165 years. And Pluto takes about 240 some odd years. These planets move so slowly that we can't even get their rhythms exactly because they're sloppy, because here on Earth we're moving around at the same time they are, and so it makes them look like they're moving in and out of their various cycles. There's been a lot of discussion already in the media and just amongst groups of people about the upcoming changes. This is not something new. Humans have been looking at the future for as far as we know, talking about the coming of a Messiah, the coming of great teachers, apocalypse, the revolution or the change that will end everything as we know it. These prophecies go back to ancient times. Most indigenous cultures have prophecies of some sort of beginning time and ending time. As someone who was born into the United States in the middle part of the 20th century, I experienced a coming of age through the 1960s when there was a resurgence of this kind of energy, this energy of a return to the garden, the hippies, the flower children, that as a child of the 60s, someone who was born in the mid-20th century, I lived through a period of time where the culture reflected one of these periods of apocalyptic change, where the zeitgeist of that time was very much one of, we can't continue the way we've been going. Things have to change. War has to end. Civilization has to get it right. That there will be great changes. We need to return to the garden. We need to eat better. We need to have peace instead of war. We need to be part of a community that based on cooperation rather than competition. All these things surfaced in the 1960s. As an astrologer, I look at the rhythms of the various slow-moving outer planets and correlate them with these big changes here on Earth. For example, it takes Uranus 84 years to make one complete revolution around the Sun. It takes Pluto about 250 years to make its complete journey, which means that about every century and a half, about every 130, 40 years, that Pluto and Uranus line up from Earth's point of view. They did this in the 1960s, in the mid-1960s. And when planets line up like this, they often correspond with huge cultural, economic, political, religious shifts. There's been a lot of talk about the upcoming 2012 as a period of such ending times. This is not only coming from the Mayan calendar, which has its long count that ends in 2012, but independent work done by Terence and Dennis McKenna as they used computer models to look at the ancient Chinese Book of Changes, the I Ching. They independently came up with a concept that they called time wave zero, where something about the quality of time was to change in 2012. And then there are prophecies of the Hopi and of other indigenous cultures who are all talking about these upcoming changes. Now, granted, this is not the first time we've had these kinds of discussions. There were talks of these kinds of changes around the Y2K, the end of the millennium. However, from an astrological point of view, it's important to understand that the changes of the 1960s were part of an astrological cycle that we can look back into history and we can see how this cycle has unfolded in the past and understand the 60s as part of this larger cycle. Even the cycle of the late 1980s, early 1990s, when again there were large changes on the planet, economic and geographical, political redistribution, that again we can look at that as part of a larger cycle. We can look at 2012 as part of one of these rhythms. Y2K, from an astrological point of view, was a non-event. However, whether or not you believe that this is a function of the Mayan calendar or a function of the I Ching and of Terence McKenna's time wave zero, the fact is that we are already in a period of rock and roll where things are going to heat up and change is upon us once again.
Okay, here's part two.
Many people know of astrology strictly through either horoscope columns or books on astrology. Many people know of astrology through individual work that they have done with an astrological consultant. As a professional astrologer, I've had the privilege of spending time with many of the great astrologers in the world. And we've had a chance to talk with many of these astrologers about what's coming up for this 2012 period. One of the important things to understand is that astrology in itself is not so much a tool to tell us how something is going to turn out. It's more importantly used to understand time as a roadmap so that we can understand the nature of the intersection that we're coming into and how that intersection corresponds or is part of a cycle of events that maybe go back in history, touch a present moment, and can be projected into the future. It is into this concept that we bring this video because we believe that it's important for all of us to get a better handle on what's happening now, because the future is not written in stone. What's written in stone is that 2012 will come after 2011, and 2013 will come after 2012, and that there are large changes in store for us. And you don't need to be an astrologer or a historian to know that these are extraordinary times. And from that standpoint, we are going to use the astrological metaphor, the astrological terminologies, the planets and the cycles and the signs in order to understand the nature of what's coming up for us on this planet, for humankind, as we move through this 2012. What's always fascinated me is the relationship between astrology and history. And as such, I've spent a lot of time looking back into the history of our country, the history of our civilization, and understand it in relationship to the movement of outer planets. For an example, we have the cycle of Uranus, which is an 84-year cycle. We have Pluto, which is about 250 years, which means that every century and a half or so, that Uranus catches up again with Pluto. And it does this in a repetitive cycle that seems to correspond with great change here on Earth. The last conjunction, when the two align together, happened in the mid-60s, and every astrologer realizes that the conjunction of Uranus and Pluto, to some extent, defined the nature of what we now call the 60s. We are coming into a period where these two great planets, Uranus, the planet of change, Uranus, the planet of sudden change, forms its first new phase or new angle with Pluto, the planet of the unconscious, Pluto, the planet of evolution. And this first meeting of these two planets since the 1960s actually begins in 2012. This is not the same phenomena as the Mayan calendar long count end. This is something different, and the two should not be confused. On the other hand, they're happening at the same time, and this becomes an interesting observation. However, we are going to talk mostly about the relationship between Uranus and Pluto and look at it from a standpoint of the 60s and pre-60s connections between these two planets, and then project forward to what's going on now and through the 2012 period of time. When we look at these outer planetary cycles, we look at two planets as a pair, as an energy, just like we look at the monthly cycle of the new moon and full moon, whereas once a month the sun and the moon line up, that's a new moon. Halfway through the cycle, they're opposite each other, that's a full moon, and then the ending of the cycle and the beginning of the next cycle is the next new moon. By the same token, we can do this with the outer planets, and they create rhythms that are of different lengths, some very short rhythms, some very long waves, and we're going to focus on the outermost planets because they create the deepest, longest waves of historical change. The 20th century was extraordinary because there were two separate alignments of these long wave planets. In the mid-1960s, we had a conjunction, that's the new moon phase, of Uranus, the planet of change, and Pluto, the planet of the underworld, the unconscious. In the early 90s, that really affected us from the late 80s through the early 90s, we had an alignment of Uranus and Neptune. Uranus, again, the planet of change, but Neptune, the planet of spirituality, of imagination. And there was a connection culturally between some of the art that was produced in the 60s and in the early 90s. But our focus today is going to be on the 60s conjunction of Uranus and Pluto, because in 2012, actually in 2012 through 2015, these two planets come to their first quarter square. They make a 90-degree angle with each other. And astrologically, just like in physics, the 90-degree angle is where the action is. To thicken the stew even further, we can talk about periods of great social change when there are these planetary pairs like Uranus and Pluto coming up in 2012 to 2015, like Uranus and Pluto in the 1960s. But sometimes these planetary pairs have a third planet that comes into the scenario. And that third planet right now is the planet Saturn, which is adding to the mix, making this Uranus-Pluto square of 2012 to 2015 even more potent, because Saturn has begun to already interact with both Uranus and Pluto. So we are feeling the front edge of the wave of 2012 to 2015, even as we record this now in 2008.
Okay, I'm back. We're going to take five here and then pick up where we left off. Here is In Excess.
Inside, dead inside, the dead inside, every single flesh on the mind. Where the weapon sharp on the knife makes you wonder how the other half died.
The devil inside, every single one of us. The devil inside, the devil inside, the devil inside, every single one of us. The devil inside, the devil inside, the devil inside, every single one of us. The devil inside, devil inside, devil inside, every single one of us. The devil inside.
About the late 80s and early 90s, those of you who are old enough may remember that period where a lot of people started getting into new agey stuff, so to speak. You know, you could see in the bookstores the constant flood of people to the quote-unquote new age section. I really do hate that term. And by the way, I have a commentary on the new age, and I may go ahead and interject that tonight. We'll see. I'm trying to figure out exactly which option I'm going to go after we get through listening to the rest of these. But I think most of you will enjoy what I have to say about that when I do get around to it, whenever that will be. So anyway, let's go ahead and go to part three. And with no further ado, again.
When we look at planetary pairs or even trios, now that we have Pluto, Uranus, and Saturn in this little cosmic dance that's unfolding from about 2006, 2007, all the way through 2015, this period of time is not only important because of the relationships that these outer planets are making with each other, but it also becomes important because we astrologers look at the planetary movement through the signs of the zodiac, which are actually related to the seasons here on Earth. Astrologically, the cardinal signs, Aries, Cancer, Capricorn, let me do that again. Astrologically, the cardinal signs, Aries, Cancer, Libra, and Capricorn, each mark the beginning of a new season. Aries is always the first moment of spring. Cancer is always the first moment of summer. Libra is always the autumnal equinox, the first moment of fall. And Capricorn is always the winter solstice, the first moment of the winter. The Mayan calendar, which ends on December 21st, 2012, interestingly enough, is corresponding to a period of time where the winter solstice is aligned with the center of our galaxy. This has been an important piece of this puzzle that's unfolding around this 2012 period of time. But from a traditional astrological point of view, what's significant is that within a few years, not only do we have an alignment of three outer planets, Saturn, Uranus, and Pluto, but each of those planets, Saturn, Uranus, and Pluto, each move through a seasonal change. Pluto moves into Capricorn. It's already moved into Capricorn, which is changes from fall to winter. Saturn is moving from Virgo to Libra, changing from summer to autumn. And we have Uranus moving from Pisces, where it's been for 7 years, into Aries, where it will be for 7 years, and it's moving from winter into spring. So the fact that we have these three planets changing seasons at the same time that they're making oppositions and squares, that's, if you think of a large cosmic-sized box or square, we have Saturn, Uranus, and Pluto, each on one corner, three corners of a four-cornered box. And this creates tremendous pressure, tremendous change here on Earth. The Age of Aquarius was made popular by the Broadway musical Hair in the mid-1960s that reflected some of the zeitgeist of that time, where there was this feeling that things were changing, the age was changing, the order was changing, that there was things were not the same as they were. And of course this connected to ideas of biblical prophecy and poets such as Yeats and Blake, who talked about, you know, changes of the world order and things of that sort. But interestingly enough, there's a very real phenomenon that corresponds with what we call the ages, even the age of Aquarius. And it works like this. If I was spinning a top, the top would spin in one direction, and as the top begins to slow down, it begins to wobble. And this is an experiment you can try at home. As the top slows down and begins to wobble, it wobbles backwards to the direction of its spin. Now, the Earth is on an angle. It spins on an angle. This is what creates our seasons, because the Earth is tilted either away from or toward the sun, depending upon whether it's summer or winter. On the equinoxes, it's on the side, so we get equal equinox, we get equal sun, day and night. Now, what happens is that this wobble makes the beginning of the seasons, like spring or summer, or fall or winter, what it does is it makes those seasons begin with a slightly different relationship with the fixed stars, because the Earth is actually wobbling, the galaxy is not, or at least it's not wobbling enough from our point of view to matter for this discussion. And what that means is that at the first moment of spring, even though there is a constellation Aries, once every 26,000 years, because that's the length of this very slow backward wobble, only once every 26,000 years is the alignment of the sun from Earth's point of view really with the exact constellation Aries. So what happens is that this backward wobble changes the alignment of the sun to the actual stars by 1 degree every 72 years, or 1/72nd of a degree a year.
Name this, what this is.
Yes. This backwards wobble of 1/72nd of a degree every year, or a complete cycle about every 26,000 years, is called the precession of the equinox, because the equinox actually moves backwards, it precesses based upon the position of the Earth in relationship to the sun, because the Earth is like a top wobbling backwards, And based upon this, each age is about 2,000 years. And here's where I love astrology, because you can't make it up this good. For the last 2,000 years, the spring equinox has been with the sun aligned in the sign of Pisces. Pisces is the symbol of the fish. It's the symbol of Christianity. Pisces has to do with martyrdom, with victimization. Pisces has to do with the two fish swimming in opposite directions, almost like the opposite forces of yin and yang are disconnected and don't know that each other exists. And yet they're connected by some sort of mystical thread. So enlightenment was reserved for the mystics in the age of Pisces, or the age of Christianity. And of course we have the whole symbolism of the Vesica Pisces, the Holy Grail. This is another topic that could be, you know, could be another DVD, and we could spend hours talking about it. It's so fascinating. But from our point of view, the connection between Pisces and Christianity, the age of Pisces, the age of Christianity. We go back 2,000 years. Remember, they go backwards. So we go backwards from the age of Pisces, and we go into the age of Aries. And in the age of Aries was the ram. We had the rise of the Hebraic religions, the one God. Aries is the I am that I am. Aries is the Paschal Lamb. It's the spring. It's that motion of creation, and Mars is the planet that relates to Aries. Then we had a God who was not compassionate like the Piscean God, the Christian God. We have a God who is ruthless, who's a warrior God. We go back 2,000 years prior to that, and we're back into the age of Taurus. Taurus is the cow. We have the rise of Hinduism, the sacred cow. We have Baal. We have, you know, we have the scene of in the Ten Commandments of worshiping the golden calf at the base of Mount Sinai. But the point is that this was a period of Taurian sensuality, of the cow, not as meat, but as an image of that which can give of itself and just be set.
Okay, who's been playing victim for the last 2,000 years? Uh-huh. Okay, the last part now.
And so on and so on. It is true that now, and defining now is a bit tricky, but now we are moving from the age of Pisces into the age of Aquarius. Because remember, the signs go backwards because the top wobbles backwards. The big question, though, is when does the age of Aquarius begin? Did it begin in the 60s? Does it begin on 2012? Did it begin with the French and American revolutions a couple hundred years ago? Remember, we're talking about a 2,000-year cycle, a 26,000-year cycle, where it's in each sign for 2,000 years. And so the transition is not in a moment. It happens in waves and waves and waves again and again and again. And it's apparent that now we are at another crest of this wave in this transition from the age of Pisces into the age of Aquarius. It seems that when these outer planets meet in conjunction, square, opposition, or square again, or conjunction again, again and again and again and again, when these outer planets meet like this, every time they do, there's a corresponding change of consciousness here on Earth. Something happens where the individual egos kind of pop, explode, jump out of their egoness. Almost like, if you can think of evolutionarily, we had fish in the ocean, and then we had mammals on the land. How did that happen? Well, I don't know if it really happened this way or not, but think of being a fish. Millions of years ago, before there were any mammals, and then under one of these outer planet transits where there's this idea that there's something else beyond what I am as a fish, you jump up out of the water, and you're above the water, and you go, because you can't breathe up there. But you look around and you go, holy smokes, there's a whole universe up here that's not water. And then you go back down into water. Well, every time there's an outer planet alignment, these conjunction squares and oppositions, we're like fish. The human race is like fish that gets glimpses of something greater. We saw it in the 60s. We saw it in the late 80s, early 90s. And we're seeing it again now, where it's not good enough to just go about our daily job, our daily work, our regular roles. Something happens where we begin to see that there's a larger thing, a larger picture. Something happens where the switch goes click, and it's no longer about who I am. It's about what is all this? And it drives us to then want to make corresponding changes. But unfortunately, these outer planetary shifts are not all fun and games, because transitions often have a darker side. There's often pain associated with any change where we have to leave something behind, and often these changes are so great, so grand, that we don't know how to incorporate the energy. In the 1960s, during the Uranus-Pluto conjunction, we saw a movement that was part of a wider movement that we can call back to nature. There was the sense of the rise of communes, of self-reliance, of wanting to be closer to nature, and to some extent it was the first wave in modern times of a what has been called a re-enchantment of the world, of the universe, because from the age of enlightenment, which Rob Hand has called the age of endarkenment, since the age of enlightenment, using science and technology, we've separated ourselves from the outer world, from the cosmos. And one of the things that came from the 1960s was the rediscovery or the reawakening of the fact that we were not separate from the outer world, that it was as alive as we are. One of the things that began to happen during the 60s, or as a result of that consciousness, was something that now we take for granted, or at least many people do, and that's the idea of recycling. The reason why this is so important is that it is a shift away from a concept of an economic model that simply cannot be sustained any longer. The British economist Thomas Malthus was responsible largely for coming up with the idea that there was a limitation to resources, to food, and that as human population increased, that the resources would become more limited, and therefore there wouldn't be enough for you and me. Therefore, I needed to make decisions so that there would be enough for me. And whether we are aware of this or not, this Malthusian economic model has driven the British Empire and the American Empire, and to some extent, it was this very assumption of our economic model that was called into question during the Uranus-Pluto conjunction of the 1960s, and then again during the Saturn-Uranus-Neptune conjunction of the late 80s, early 90s. In fact, one of the biggest switches in this idea of the limited environment was the crash of the Exxon Valdez in Alaska, which at that time seemed remotely far away. And yet, in one event, and interestingly enough, this event happened within 12 hours of an exact alignment of Saturn, the planet of limitation, Saturn, the planet of rock, Saturn, the planet of you get what you deserve. Saturn aligned with Neptune, the planet that astrologically is symbolic of oil, symbolically of alcohol, symbolic of alcohol. Neptune, which is symbolic of the high seas, of the oceans. And so what we had is within 12 hours of an exact alignment that happens every few decades, we had Saturn aligning with Neptune, and all of a sudden we realized that our use of oil created its own reality when it hit the rocks on the high seas, when someone was drinking alcohol, and all of a sudden we all knew that there was a limitation. Now, these kinds of events happen again and again where something fulfills the imagery from Earth's point of view. But the important thing here is that we are now moving from the 60s through the early 90s, now into this 2012 period of time where we haven't gotten it right yet. And the intensity of the game has gone up a notch because we're either going to figure it out or we're not, and we may not get another shot at it.
Okay, I'm back. I see we have a caller on the line. I'm not going to take calls tonight. If you're calling to listen, that's fine, but I'm not going to take calls. What I'm going to do here, I've got three more videos, and this gets really more interesting as we go along here. And the second video in particular, really gets into some interesting stuff. And you'll have a better grasp on what really went on during the 1960s when you listen to that video. So right now I'm going to go ahead and play a very short song. It's about 3.5 minutes, and we'll be right back.
It's the woman. woman in you that makes you wanna play this game.
Okay, I'm back. I'm going to, what I'm going to do here is play these back to back without any interruption. Pay real close attention to what this guy says. Some of it may get a little technical if you're not familiar with the astrological jargon, but nevertheless, you'll still get something out of it. Now, more than likely, my final comments will probably go into the archives. Each one of these is about 9 minutes and 30 seconds. It's going to be real close. Now, I will say this. Keep in mind here, if you've been following along with what's going on in the Truther movement, you know that in 2011, a hippie movement was created on a social network by a man named Freeman, and a network that no longer exists. Okay? Now, I recently read an article here not too long ago, and I passed it on to some of the people here on Renegade about how the Jews are going to try to create a new hippie movement. Well, I would say that was probably the beginning of it. And we'll see what happens here. So anyway, let's go ahead and move on and pay close attention.
The idea of synchronicity is that it describes the coincidence of events, one of which is inside and the other is outside, in which the connection between the two is meaning, rather than it being a linear causal connection, like one billiard ball hitting another billiard ball and moving off and with the same amount of force. Instead, something happens in the outside world that so perfectly reflects something happening in the inside of a person, a dream, an image, an experience of some sort that's internal, that it awakens one to the idea that there is some deeper principle of order at work in the world, connecting inner and outer. For example, when we look at astrological synchronicities, there can be the coincidence between specific planetary movements and an event or a series of events, all of which have a certain similar character, an archetypal character, that corresponds to the planets involved in that particular configuration that coincides with the events. Well, it is a coinage that Jung made in 1930. But he's taking it from the Greek terms chronos, time, and syn, S-Y-N, basically with the same time, at the same time, two events happening at the same time that are meaningfully connected. And Jung really is taking something that was almost a matter of common consensus, common perception for the ancients, for ancient and indigenous tribal traditional cultures. They lived in a synchronistic universe. It was always, things were happening all the time that were synchronistic. They just didn't have a term for it because it wasn't anything that was out of the ordinary. It's only in the context of the modern worldview that synchronicity has to be formulated as a concept, because in the modern worldview, life unfolds randomly, and the idea of meaningful order is something that comes from human beings. Meaning is a human phenomenon for the modern mind, and so it's when people start recognizing that outer events meaningfully coincide with each other or with an inner state of consciousness, that is an anomaly for the modern mind. It disrupts the assumption of randomness that is the underlying assumption of the modern worldview. Pauli was Jung's friend and actually patient for a while, but also friend and frequent interlocutor, talking about physics, talking about the whole notion of synchronicity. And it was shaped by Pauli's knowledge of quantum physics. Jung actually says that his first thoughts about synchronicity were stimulated in conversations with Einstein, in who he had dinner with a number of times back in around 1911, 1912 in Zurich. And then it was later in the 40s that in conversations with Pauli that the notion of synchronicity developed more and more. And so by the time Jung finally came out in 1951 with the major paper on synchronicity that he, well, first he gave the lecture at Eranos. The final, his final presentation at Eranos in 1951 was on synchronicity, and then he gave a, wrote a longer monograph that was published the following year. And then finally he published that with Pauli's essay on Kepler and Robert Fludd and archetypes in an English edition in 1955. Actually, the first time that Jung publicly used the word synchronicity was in the in his memorial tribute in 1930 to Richard Wilhelm. I think we can approach synchronicity and diachronicity if we particularly look at the astrological context, because there it's very clear. We have two basic patterns that you see when you're looking at the major outer planet cycles in relationship to the unfolding of cultural history. The basic idea is that the collective psyche and its archetypal dynamics seem to unfold in correspondence with the unfolding of the planetary movements and the major cycles, particularly the conjunctions and the oppositions of the outer planets. And the synchronic patterns that we notice take place when you have a particular conjunction, let's say, of two outer planets. Let's take the Uranus-Pluto conjunction of the 1960s. When you bring the Uranian principle that has to do with rebellion, freedom, the impulse to the, make the world new, innovation, technological advance, the overall impulse towards individualistic originality and radical change. Okay, all that's Uranus. And then you have Pluto. And Pluto intensifies and compels with elemental force whatever it touches. In this case, this Uranian principle, which I think of as being very connected to the Promethean impulse for freedom and innovation and rebellion. It compels us with great intensity. And when we look at the 1960s, during which this, the only time in the 20th century that Uranus and Pluto were in conjunction was during the 1960s. And it was during that conjunction that in many different fields, in many different countries, simultaneously, you had this upsurge of innumerable cultural events in social and political contexts, in artistic contexts, sexual revolution, social turmoil, the impulse for political rebellion, independence movements, civil rights movements, feminism, the rock counterculture, student rebellions, anti-war movements, anti-colonial independence movements, and so forth. Movies, music, whatever part of human activity you looked at, simultaneously across the world, there was a synchronistic, or we can just say synchronic, simultaneous convergence of cultural events and impulses, all of which had a similar character. But then we also notice with these, as we look at these historical cycles across time, we notice that there is a diachronic pattern that is equally striking. And so when we look at previous eras in which Uranus and Pluto, for example, were in conjunction or were within in opposition, those are the two big, you know, conjunction and opposition are like the new moon and the full moon point of any planetary cycle. In this case, a huge cycle, Uranus and Pluto. Well, if we look back in history, at other times these two planets came into alignment, again you get, let's take the sequence of from the French Revolution, during the French Revolutionary decade, Uranus and Pluto were again in alignment, a tight opposition. And again you had social rebellion, political revolution, sexual revolution, impulse for artistic innovation and creativity, technological advance, scientific revolution, impulse to make the world new.
Okay, we're going to go to part two here, and remember what I was saying earlier, keep in mind Fabian socialism.
Turmoil and so forth, right across, not just in France, but it was happening in England, in the Caribbean, in the mutiny on the Bounty in Tahiti. It's happening all at once across the world, and the same impulses that were at work at that point. Let's just take, for example, the very first feminist manifesto is written under the Uranus-Pluto alignment, 1792-93, Mary Wollstonecraft. Fast forward to the 1960s, Uranus-Pluto conjunction, and again, you have this burst of feminism and empowerment of women. Same thing with the civil rights movement. 1960s, you have Martin Luther King, you've got Malcolm X, you've got Nelson Mandela, and so forth. Tremendous impulse to liberate, to transform the social structure and liberate African Americans or people of color throughout the world. Go back to the Uranus-Pluto alignment of the French Revolutionary period, and that's when you have the emergence of the abolition movements, the first freeing of the slaves by the French Revolutionary government frees them in the French colonies, the basic beginning of a black civil rights movement happens at that point. So that's an example of a diachronic or patterning in which the same kind, within a particular field, a particular area of human activity, in this case, feminism and women's suffrage or and women's rights, or let's say civil rights and abolition movement, you can track that either synchronically, all these similar events happening at the same time, or diachronically, the same genre of events happening at different times, but in coincidence with a sequence of cyclical alignments of the same planets. If we look at what I've just described, the Uranus-Pluto alignment of the French Revolutionary period and the Uranus-Pluto alignment of the 1960s. Well, in between, there were two other conjunction, one other conjunction and one other opposition in between. Altogether, we're looking at a period of approximately 200 years. And in those intermediary alignments, the conjunction took place in the late 1840s and early 1850s. And that's precisely when 1848, across Europe, virtually every capital in Europe, Paris, Rome, Prague, Dresden, had a revolution almost simultaneously. And all the way through the later 1840s and early 50s, you have, again, the abolition movement reached a peak. That's what basically catalyzed the Civil War in the United States. That's when Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote her Uncle Tom's Cabin, which had an enormous effect on catalyzing social the social conscience of the United States, and John Brown's raid, and Lincoln coming into the newly founded Republican Party, which had a different character in those years than the present version of it. And you also had Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman with her great efforts to liberate the slaves from the South, and you had the great former slave Frederick Douglass writing his autobiography. All these had an enormous effect on the civil rights and abolition movement of that time. And at the same time, you have 1848, the first women's suffrage convention that takes place in New York, upstate New York. You have Susan B. Anthony is there, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Lucy Mott, and so forth. It was the real beginning of the women's movement that climaxes under the very next conjunction in the 1960s when Betty Friedan writes The Feminine Mystique, National Organization of Women is founded, radical feminism emerges in the late 60s, and we're still living out the consequences of that. So, and I could point out similar, this is the period of when, going back to the 1840s conjunction, this is when Henry David Thoreau writes Civil Disobedience and basically sets in motion the movement towards nonviolent rebellion, disobedience against established governments that leads to Martin Luther King's great efforts under the next conjunction of the 1960s. So there, one could do the same thing in literature, in music. You've got Wagner. You know, you had Beethoven under the preceding one during the French Revolutionary epoch. Beethoven is blowing the mind of the Viennese public as he comes in with this, you know, titanically revolutionary piano playing. And then under the very next conjunction, you've got Wagner blowing the mind of the European opera audiences with the power of his music and this kind of Promethean, Dionysian, you know, potency that music had never known before. And then under the conjunction of the 60s, well, if you have Beethoven at the one point, you've got Jimi Hendrix coming into London and you know, completely transforming the parameters of what music can do. And it's not, of course, just Hendrix. It's the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan doing it with protest music and then electric rock. And you've got, you know, The Who and Led Zeppelin and Janis Joplin and so forth, just completely expanding the possibilities of what human beings can express and artistically enact. So then you have the opposition in the basically the late 1890s, beginning of the 1900s, 1896 to 1906, approximately that decade. Basically, these big conjunctions and oppositions. We're looking at a 15 degree orb, which is essentially how long a full moon looks to be full. When you look at a full moon, it's basically full from about 15 degrees before exact until 15 after. It's basically two nights that a moon looks to be full. Same thing with the new moon. It's gone for the period of about 15 degrees before and after. And that's empirically what we find if we track carefully the occurrence of events that have a particular archetypal character. They take place in coincidence with the relevant planetary conjunction or opposition for a period that seems to be most emphatically visible from 15 degrees before into 15 degrees after. And that, in terms of number of years for the Uranus-Pluto alignments, is approximately a dozen years. Again, you have, let's just take the technological advances, which is something we only spoke of briefly before, but while in the 60s you've got tremendous technological advances with, you know, computers and rockets and the space program going up to reaching the moon and so forth. Let's just take aviation and space, jets and the space expeditions of the 1960s. Well, if you go back to the preceding opposition, that's when the very first aviation experiments of any kind happened by the Wright brothers, with the first glider experiments in 1900, and then 1903 the first powered flight. And if you if we were to look at something like the women's suffrage movement during that period becomes tremendously empowered in both England and the United States during the late 1890s and early 1900s.
Okay, I'm back. I hope you found that very informative. So now you see how the Jews take advantage of these astrological opportunities to subvert what should be something positive into something totally perverted. Okay, now we got one more segment of this guy. What I've decided to do here while I was listening to that, I'm going to go ahead and after I play this next one, I'm going to play another song. And then I've got one more that I'm going to play tonight, another astrologer, one who we will all recognize. And so this will go into the archives. And so in order to catch that, you will have to download this show. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and read my essay on the it's not mine actually, I kind of called it, and I'm going to read that and close out with some final comments. So anyway, we got about approximately 13 minutes left in the live show, so I'll talk to you after this next segment.
This is when our image of the women, the suffragettes, that's from this period. And then we also see during, it was also when the first voting was given to women in a number of countries during that period. And Virginia Woolf starts emerging as a major, she and the Bloomsbury set kind of emerge right at that point. You've got in music, you've got Mahler and Stravinsky are starting to, you know, again, this kind of new elemental power is starting to come in. And same thing in painting, where you've got it starting to come into Picasso and this, again, you know, this impulse to for radical change and for innovation, breaking through previous ways of artistic expression. Also, this is when radical socialism becomes widespread at this point, the beginning of the Menshevik party, the Bolshevik party, the major socialist parties in France and the United States and England, Italy, and so forth. They're all founded right during that alignment. And then when you get to the 1960s, the radical political movements just spread like wildfire, and people like you know, Che and Castro and the Red Guards and the Cultural Revolution and Marxism and the Students for a Democratic Society with radical socialist or radical political views are very widespread during the 1960s. So again, it's a synchronic and diachronic pattern. So generally, we see the square, it's a 10 to 12 degree orb that typically we start seeing the major phenomena happening. And in fact, this has already started to occur. 2006, 2007 is when it started getting within orb. And it's quite striking how astrologers knew the Uranus-Pluto square was coming. This is for years, obviously. And we have known that this is the first major dynamic alignment or aspect of these two planets since the 1960s. But when we were discussing this in 2002 or 2003, 2004, one didn't have a sense of anything happening. And we knew theoretically, in terms of the diachronic patterns, it should be happening pretty soon, coming up for the, you know, the, after 2007, 2008, we should be seeing these kinds of cultural phenomena. But you didn't feel it anywhere. The sense of was that the revolution was dead in the water, was kind of the feeling. And of course, during this period of 2001, 2004, Saturn was opposite Pluto, and then that was the period of, you know, 9/11 and the Iraq War invasion and the empowerment of the conservative right wing in with the Bush administration and so forth. And then right after that, the Saturn opposition to Neptune took place, which was a, kind of put a wet blanket of demoralization as well as skepticism. The two went together into the collective psyche. But quite strikingly, beginning around 2006, 2007, you started feeling, we all started feeling the tremors of something new, an empowerment of youth. I haven't mentioned that, but the empowerment of youth is a very typical correlation with the Uranus-Pluto alignments, because Uranus and the Promethean impulse have to do with that part of the human community that carries innovation, which youth, of course, is especially likely to carry. So typically these periods do coincide with the empowerment of youth, and in fact, it was right during these last couple of years that we started sensing it with, for example, the Obama rise to prominence politically was to an important extent carried by the renewed activism in the political sphere by youth who had not renewed since the 1960s. This generation had not been particularly active until the Uranus-Pluto square started coming into orb. And Obama's a good example of someone who's born under the under the conjunction of the 1960s. So more than any other presidential candidate, he is carrying the archetypal mood and promise, as it were, of that era. He's got it within him. He himself recognizes that what he's had to work through in his own life is in many ways what the 60s counterculture was seeking to move towards a resolution of at the time he was born and afterwards. He was born just as the civil rights movement was just rising with great force, 1961. And now here he is under the square, in some sense representing the spirit of the time, the zeitgeist. But in general, we know that these two planets will get closer and closer together until they become exact in 2012 and then move back and forth, reaching exact alignment several times between 2012, 2015, and really all the way until 2020, that this larger square, 13, 14 years altogether, will be in orb. But the peak of it is undoubtedly coming during this next decade, and next 8 years we could be more specific. And I think what we can generally look forward to is, first of all, more social and political turmoil, an impulse for change, for radical change. That impulse will partly come from the reformers and progressive and radical forces within the human community, but it's also going to be the obligation to change coming from external events and forces that have been set in motion by other things over the decades and are now going to require us to let go of the past and make changes and make radical changes. So it won't always be comfortable. I mean, those of us who are progressive in our political and social orientation can tend to think of, I mean, and I think rightly so, these periods are periods of great excitement and energy and increase the passion for creativity and the new and for freedom. But there is a great potential. You know, Pluto doesn't draw the line in any judicious way. It's a volcano going off. It's a tempestuous energy, and people. I mean, actually, the more we learn and integrate the lessons of the 1960s, the more this next decade will be one that would be more judiciously played out, so that the powerful forces for change are balanced by adequate recognition of what structures are worth retaining and what disciplines and what virtues that involve, you know, discipline, for example, or rigor, or loyalty, or the value, certain values of particular traditions. Not everything should be thrown over, or else a lot of problematic and violent chaos can occur. There is a possibility of a kind of unleashing of a will to power that is not always life enhancing. It can be destructive, and so a lot will depend in these next few years on how well we can balance the old and the new, and the impulse for freedom with the legitimate claims of valuable structures and traditions.
Okay, I'm back. Will to power. Okay, we've got a lot of catching up to do. There's time, but there's a lot of catching up to do. I've been trying to get this information out to people for years, but everything has fallen on deaf ears until now. So we have our work cut out for us, and in particular you young people. You've got to step up. This is your opportunity. If you do not step up, guess what other youth are going to win out? All the ones who are deluded with the Jewish brainwashing. Okay? So there you have it. And I hope you thoroughly enjoyed that guy's interview, because that was probably the most informative one that I have found on the net on those topics related to astrology and the aspect of transiting Uranus, squaring transiting Pluto. I'm going to play one more song, and then I'll be right back.
Daddy?
Yes, son? Well, son, a funny thing about regret is that it's better to regret something you have done than to regret something you haven't done. And by the way, if you see your mom this weekend, you should be sure and tell her,
Satan! Satan! Satan!
Okay, I'm back. That was the Butthole Surfers. Yes, I know exactly what the implications of that are. So anyway, but, you know, there was a reference to Satan in there, so I thought I would just play that. What I have next, before I get into this essay on the New Age issues, is someone we are all familiar with. And I'm in agreement probably with around 80% of what his theories are that he has presented publicly. I suspect in private he probably holds somewhat a different view, but he does make his living off of the truth movement. And in a certain kind of way, I can't blame him. And but at the same time, what he has sold to the truth movement, for the most part, has actually been very valid information. He's done a lot of great work, and he is also an astrologer, and so therefore I can't fault him too much. I've considered trying to make contact with him and possibly interviewing him, but I don't know how he would feel about talking to a nationalist. You know, it would have an effect on his truth movement sales, but, you know, we'll see. Maybe the times are changing enough to where he would be willing to talk. I have communicated with him via email before. I'm sure a lot of people have. I'm not the only one. So anyway, his name is Michael Tesserion. Back in the I guess it was around 2007, 2006, he had done some presentations where he discussed Pluto. And I'm going to go ahead and play about a 9-minute segment of him. And he makes some interesting observations. So anyway, here we go.
And coming more to the point, we have something important that's going to happen this year. We're talking about Mayan countdowns and 13-year cycles and age of revealing and all of that. Well, listen, if you haven't felt it before, it's going to start happening soon. In November of this year, and for the whole of 2007, all the way up to 2012, there's a very major cycle that's going to begin. We've been talking about time and cycle and all of that. Well, there's another cycle you need to know about that's approaching us very, very soon. And it's the coming in of the planet Pluto. Now, I wish I could get more into the concept that when I'm talking about the planets, I'm not talking about the effects of rocks in space with magic rays. People who know my work on astrology know that I know about an inner zodiac. The whole idea is that these rocks in space just represent energies. They are not the thing itself. So don't get me wrong there. But Pluto is an archetype that represents a certain kind of energy that is actually psychological in nature. That's all I can say for now. People can contact me and we can go into greater depth. There's information on the Taroscope's website more about what I mean by these planets and zodiacs. Anyway, we have the planet Pluto. But what is Pluto? What does it matter that it's coming in? Because in November of this year, it's going to be crossing galactic center and channeling energy from the center of the galaxy. And that's in late Sagittarius. Pluto, the planet of destruction, and I prefer the word deconstruction, because really, if you think about it, nothing is ever destroyed. It's just transmuted. And radical change will be crossing galactic center and channeling that energy of the central sun in early 2007. It takes approximately 250 years for Pluto to complete one circuit of the zodiac or 12 signs. We saw the 12 signs. Well, now think of one planet moving very, very slowly. Because the Sun and Mercury and Venus and some of the other planets we know, they move very, very quickly. And their effects then are very, very sort of short-lived. Even though if you're sensitive, you can always feel them. That's what astrology is all about, is the mapping and charting of the effects of these bodies. But Pluto moves very slowly and has very, very dramatic effect. Now, Pluto is presently approximately 24 degrees of Sagittarius. Please excuse me if you're not familiar with this astrological jargon. And when it moves into Capricorn, the sign of order and government, Capricorn, right, the sign of order and government, it will auger in cataclysmic upheavals and exposure of all corruption in order to restore harmony. In fact, a lot of what you're seeing in the exposures recently have been because it's moving in. It's already coming. Its orbit is 250 years, so about 3-4 years ago, already, what you might even say, the turn of the millennium, let's say, already the effects of Pluto have been felt, but it's going to get stronger and stronger and stronger, like a dimmer turning up. It augurs in the exposure of all corruption in order to restore harmony and a higher way of being. Individual lives will also be dramatically transformed. Pluto comes to check psychic immunity. We all know about physical immunity. If you don't have it, you've got a disease, right? Pluto is the surgeon coming in to say, roll up the sleeve, say ah. It's going to check the psychic immunity. And it brings with it a deep cleansing cycle. One can think of it as nature's psychic surgeon. It's interesting, too, because it is connected. Pluto is connected to psychology. Pluto was discovered in 1930, but it had been searched for at about 1900, exactly the time that Sigmund Freud started writing and releasing and publishing his works. Pluto, I believe, is the planetary ruler of Germany, but it is very much the ruler of psychology. And I've always thought it's interesting that the word sanity comes from the same word roots as sanitize, meaning that if you're not sanitized, you're not sane. What do I mean by that? We clean everything in our world. We wouldn't dream of eating off the same dirty plates twice. We make our beds, we take showers, we clean the driveway, right? In Ireland, they're out there polishing their cars on Sunday morning, groom the dog. Everything in our life is clean. How come not our emotions? How come they're as toxic as hell and we're walking around loose in the world thinking, we got problems, let me fix it. Ever try cleaning a nice clean window with an oily rag and then saying you can't see the garden? Well, the oily rag in your hand is the one messing up the window. So if we're finding disorder and chaos in the world, could it be our smudge, our forensic mess that we're leaving behind? Could be in the eye of the beholder, as they say. Now, Robert Hand, the astrologer, says that the nature of Pluto is similar to that of the Hindu god Shiva. It's an interesting statement. Pluto usually begins by breaking down a structure, then creates a new one in its place. The entire cycle of death, destruction, and renovation is accompanied by tremendous powers. For Pluto is not a mild or even a very Pluto is not a mild or even very subtle planetary influence. It brings decay at one level or another. Pluto also rules death and regeneration of the self, as old aspects of your life pass away. Pluto does not represent death in the literal sense. Instead, it refers to a metaphorical death, something that ceases to be. And those who know about this stuff know that when you're feeling the effects of Pluto, it's going to be in your relationships that you're going to feel it first. Forget about Capitol Hill and White House and all of that. You're going to feel it much closer to home. But he mentioned Shiva the Destroyer, the third god of the Hindu Trinity. Now, we don't have too much insight into the sane mind, but we can certainly recognize the unsane mind. At least that much we can do. But in short, the schizophrenic mind creates a schizogenic society. You don't need to be Freud to know that. The pathological mind creates a pathogenic society. The toxic mind sees and creates a toxic world. And we can recognize it on the big scale. But can you recognize it closer to home? Actually, no, we can't. Barbara Hahn-Clow in her Pleiadian Agenda says, you all have miasmas in your bodies that you must release. These are etheric masses that hold memory from genetic past lives. They're disease patterns. And we feel uncomfortable with them. It's time to get rid of them. But we really don't want to do that. We escape from it. That's right. Avoidance and tranquilization. We don't want to do all that psychology and self-investigation. Where's the authority figures who will just lead us where we need to go? They'll teach us all how to do it. But don't you see that by your avoidance to deal with your dark psychic content, that you are in fact funding and permitting the most hideous leviathans to poison and intoxicate the human race? Because they will step on to the white square of the chessboard if you don't occupy it. Then don't blame them for their existence if you have allowed them to rise. Now, Pluto is, anyone here Scorpio? Sun sign Scorpio? Right. Then you know, obviously, that Pluto is your ruling planet. Pluto is your god of the sign of Scorpio. And therefore, where is Scorpio in the seasonal cycle? Right? It's late. It's at the winter cycle. So Pluto rules when the sun goes into the winter seasonal cycle. And it's the same thing psychologically. Pluto rules what is known as the underworld cycle in alchemy or psychology. And, of course, we all go through the underworld cycle, whether we know about astrology or not. It's often been called in the New Age movement the dark night of the soul. Carl Jung said that the foundation of mental illness, all mental illness, is unwillingness to experience legitimate suffering. Because we resist a certain amount of this looking at the dark side, especially of ourselves, and a willing entrance into, because remember, all of us are going through the dark night of the soul, and we'll have to go through this underworld phase, just as the sun has to go through its one seasonally. You're not going to escape it. The only difference is that you can either decide to do it of your own free will, then it's ritualistic, or you can be dragged. The hanged man has a smile on his lips. It's a willing oblation. Did not Odin, when he hung on the tree of life in order to learn the secret of the runes, he did it willingly. Nobody forced Buddha to sit down in front of the tree when he wanted to contemplate the meaning of life. It's a Conan and the Barbarian situation. You must willingly be crucified and die to be reborn again. Of course, we've forgotten all of those rituals, but nevertheless, it goes through your life. It's not that suffering is good. Suffering is built into the universe. You're going to have it just like you have pleasure. It's your unwillingness, unwholesome unwillingness to deal with it and to accept it for what it is, which is like the sword saying, I don't want to go through the fire of the blacksmith. Well, then you're not a sword, period. Now, countries go through these great cycles, the seasons go through it, and so do the psyche.
Okay, I'm back. I'm going to go ahead and read this called essay that I have on several topics. It's about Wicca, the New Age, the term Celtic. I'll talk about that first before I actually get started on the essay itself. And then this threefold law and tenfold, however many things you want to come up with. Basically, this concept of the New Age term karma, which is a whole lot of crap, okay? And needs to be discussed and brought out. Now, the term Celtic, it's really a modern construction. I know the word is ancient, and it was a word used, I think, mainly by the Romans in reference to the Teutonic peoples, the Germanic peoples in particular. But, it's really Teutonic more than it is Celtic, okay? And so, anyway, I'll go ahead and get started here on this. And then afterwards I have some more comments before I finalize the show, and I'll play some more music too. I'm going to say some things here about Wicca, since it is real popular, and all it really does mainly is provide a means for severely unpopular women to get naked and dance to drumming around a campfire. Lesbians, gays, and wimpy men in general really seem to be attracted to this for whatever reason as well. Wicca and New Age are the Judeo-Christianized version of witchcraft. One of the major goals of Christianity is to destroy the past and replace it with fictitious versions that conform to the lie of Christianity. Recently, they've been working to turn the religion into a goddess cult by gradually getting rid of the horn gods so there will be fewer and fewer ties with the original religions. Wicca and New Age are both a bogus movement, not based upon the facts, but like Christianity, it is based upon stolen and altered rites and teachings. Like Christianity, it depends upon the ignorance of its followers to thrive. Wicca is simply Satanism light. It is a waste of time and for fools. I will elaborate further by explaining the Wiccan threefold law of return. I want to expose this lie and its origins. The threefold, the tenfold, the hundredfold, however many folds you want to give this, all of these were invented by a few to frighten the masses in order to maintain spiritual control. With the availability of knowledge in modern times, witchcraft could no longer be suppressed, so the oppressors had to find a way to keep it in line so real power and control can remain in the hands of the few. These few know the truth and are adepts in black magic, which they use liberally to spiritually enslave the masses. They control the mainstream religions that are nothing but programs to suppress knowledge and control humanity. The following information exposes this lie for what it is. Now, there's going to be some French in here, and as I've said before, someone from Southeast Texas just ain't going to speak French real well, so I'll try to get through some of this as best I can. The first known reference in print to the threefold law of return appeared in 1970 in a book called Witchcraft, Ancient and Modern, by Raymond Buckland, who was initiated into the craft by Gerald Gardner. It was instrumental in introducing Gardnerian witchcraft into the United States. With enough research, it is evident that the threefold emerged with the Gardnerian tradition. Then we have the sevenfold, and I'm sure everyone has heard of the tenfold. My point here is none of this recent man-made nonsense has anything to do with the original religions. Its sole purpose is to keep people from using their inborn power and to promote a passive attitude that is accepting of abuse. This is no different from the Christian church. This threefold teaching was taken from the Eastern concept of karma after it emerged with Western Christianity. After the Eastern teachings of karma picked up the Judeo-Christian overtones of divine punishment, the product evolved into yet another system of control with the same theme of keeping power in the hands of a few who know how to use it to exploit humanity. One thing led to another, and Gerald Gardner added more to this and promoted the belief that witches must never use their powers to cause harm. Everyone has to take abuse and keep the passive attitude. The Wiccan read, "And it harm none, do what ye will." According to Gardner, the creed is derived from good King Palsal, who declared, "Do what you like so long as you harm no one." King Palsal is a fictitious character from the French novel by Pierre Louis called Les Adventures du Roi Palsal, or something along those lines, in 1901, reprinted in 1925, numerous times since. Or The Adventures of King Palsal, or The Body Good-Natured Sovereign. This is the basis of Wicca. Wicca is nothing more than a Christianized version of the old religions. Wiccans have taken selected rites and teachings to suit their whims from the original religions and have twisted, corrupted, and transformed them, and are now passing themselves off as the original religion. As I've said before, they like to cut the head off of the original, put theirs on top, and then prance around and act as if theirs is the original and everyone else is a copycat. They do that with everything. The hypocrisy can be readily seen in the gods they acknowledge. Many, if not most, of these gods and goddesses that they claim to worship were the ones who brought the teachings of magic to humans, both white and black magic. They are known as the Fallen Ones. The original horn god is Satan. In addition, few Wiccans bother to do any in-depth research regarding the gods and goddesses they commune with and worship. Most of these deities are of the satanic pantheon of hell. Many Wiccans and more pagans